Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
People Fixing the World is the podcast looking for solutions to the problems we face today.
It could potentially ease the suffering of millions.
We have a solution. Let's do it.
People Fixing the World from the BBC World Service.
BBC.
BBC.
You're with the BBC. Hello, welcome to a special edition of World Book Club, coming from the Times Cheltenham Literature Festival in southwest England. I'm Harriet Gilbert, and you find me in an enormous tent packed with readers impatient to discuss this month's book. It's a detective novel, you could say, or, depending on how you look at it, three short interlocked detective stories, in all of which follower and followed, chaser and pursued, merge disturbingly into one another. The book's called The New York Trilogy, and here to answer questions about it from the audience and BBC listeners around the world is its multiply award-winning author, the American Paul Auster. Paul, welcome to the World Book Club.
Thank you for having me.
And to Cheltenham, of course. One thing worries me. I know, or I believe, that you absolutely have to write every day. And I'm just worried how you cope with that when you're travelling.
Well, the fact is, I don't have to write every day because there are moments when I'm not engaged in a project. I'm not a machine. And when I finish a book, I'm pretty exhausted. And it might take weeks, if not months, before I'm ready to start something else. It so happens that I've recently finished something. So at the moment, I haven't been writing for the last 2 or 3 weeks.
Well, I'm delighted that we're not interrupting anything because Paul Auster is an author with a unique voice and perspective, a player of literary games that are both entertaining and deeply unsettling. Besides novels, he's written poetry, essays, literary translations, screenplays, including for one of my favourite ever movies, Smoke, and autobiographies, of which the most recent is his memoir, Winter Journal. But it was the New York Trilogy that marked his breakthrough. Published in the mid-1980s, to date it's sold 1.5 million copies in 35 languages. Pretty spectacular for what is actually an anti-detective novel. Instead of cosily resolving mysteries, it goes on creating more and more through a sequence of stories that discordantly echo one another. In part one of the trilogy, City of Glass, a novelist called Quinn turns private eye to track down a man whom he's been told is planning to harm his own son. In part two, Ghosts, a professional private detective, Blue, is asked to watch a man named Black, in this case for no very clear reason. And in part three, The Locked Room, a third man sets out in search of a writer who was once a close friend of his. So, echoes inside echoes, mirrors within mirrors. But I'm going to be more straightforward and ask Paul Auster if he'd start at the beginning and, in fact, read from the very first page of the New York Trilogy.
I'll be happy to do this. I have to tell you all that I haven't looked at these books in many, many years. They were written in the early 1980s. So this is the very beginning of City of Glass, the first novel in the series. It was a wrong number that started it. The telephone ringing 3 times in the dead of night, and the voice on the other end asking for someone he was not. Much later, when he was able to think about the things that happened to him, he would conclude that nothing was real except chance. But that was much later. In the beginning, there was simply the event and its consequences. Whether it might have turned out differently, or whether it was all predetermined with the first word that came from the stranger's mouth, is not the question. The question is the story itself, and whether or not it means something is not for the story to tell. As for Quinn, there is little that need detain us. Who he was, where he came from, and what he did are of no great importance. We know, for example, that he was 35 years old. We know that he had once been married, had once been a father, and that both his wife and son were now dead. We also know that he wrote books. To be precise, we know that he wrote mystery novels. These works were written under the name of William Wilson, and he produced them at the rate of about one a year, which brought in enough money for him to live modestly in a small New York apartment. Because he spent no more than 5 or 6 months on a novel, for the rest of the year he was free to do as he wished. He read many books. He looked at paintings. He went to the movies. In the summer, he watched baseball on television. In the winter, he went to the opera. More than anything else, however, what he liked to do was walk. Nearly every day, rain or shine, hot or cold, he would leave his apartment to walk to the city, never really going anywhere, but simply going wherever his legs happened to take him.
Paul Auster, thank you very much indeed for that. And our first question about the New York trilogy comes to you from Sydney in Australia. It's from Stephen Reynolds, and he rang the World Book Club earlier to ask this.
Hi, Paul. My name's Steve Reynolds, and I'm calling you from Sydney, Australia. And this is my question. Many of your books concern themselves with the issue of identity or questions about the self. Are we really who we think we are? How are we defined, and by whom? I'm wondering, to what extent is your fiction a deliberate exploration of your own life, or your own self, or possible selves? Thank you very much, Paul.
So, how much are you exploring your own lives, plural, your own selves, plural?
Well, it's a very good question, and it's a very difficult question to answer, because the fact is, when one is writing fiction, you don't really know where it's all coming from. And I myself tend to work in a very unconscious way. I don't go out looking for stories. I never sit down and say to myself, I want to write a novel about something. It's the unconscious that's doing the work. Things bubble to the surface. Often it takes years before the first glimmer of an idea coalesces into something that I want to write about or that feels necessary to write about. The question of autobiographical elements in my novels. Yes, it's true that at times I've used events from my own life, sometimes very small events.
In this novel, for instance?
In City of Glass, I can think of nothing that directly relates to my own experience, except the fact that there's a character in City of Glass named Paul Auster, and he's married to a woman named Siri. Siri being Siri Hustvedt, the wife of Paul Auster in the book and the wife of the Paul Auster sitting in front of you right now. I was very interested in this book to take the name on the cover and put it inside and see what would happen. So the Paul Auster who's presented in the novel as a character resembles me in many ways, and he looks like me. But at the same time, nearly everything he says is exactly the opposite of what I, the real Paul Auster, in his own body sitting before you, really believes. And in a sense, I'm poking fun at myself in this book. And the Auster character is rather a ridiculous and pompous, if somewhat friendly, fellow. But it was interesting to do this. I've never done it since. So yes, autobiography is there at times, but generally not, because I myself have written autobiographical works. And so in those books, I'm directly addressing events from my own life. In the novels, I might be taking a small thing and twisting it into something else. But I think this is true of all novelists. I mean, everyone is drawing on his or her own experiences and turning it into something that one hopes winds up being art.
Paul Auster, thank you very much. And now a question from the audience here at Cheltenham.
Good afternoon. My name's Ben Jacob. I have a question about how your stories take shape. Do you think of an ending first, or do you take one of these ideas which bubble up unconsciously as a starting point? Do you plan it all the way through to the end, or do you just start writing and see how things evolve?
The fact is that it's a little bit of all of those things. Often it takes years for a book to come into focus for me to feel ready to begin writing. And at that point, I seem to have a sense of the beginning and the middle and the end, the so-called shape of the book. And, of course, you can't begin without a first sentence. The first sentence is the thing that is somehow given to you by the gods. It's there or it's not there. And once it is there, it's the propulsive instrument that gets you into what you're doing. There have been books that I've started, and I knew what the last sentence was going to be as well. And, you know, a sense of this arc. On the other hand, once I sit down and begin to write, things begin to change. And ideas that I thought were interesting or even compelling before I started turn out to be of no interest whatsoever. But the writing itself seems to generate other thoughts and more thoughts about all kinds of things. And so that every book I've written has turned out differently from the way I thought it would be when I sat down to begin.
The very first sentence of this novel, "It was a wrong number that started it," that actually did come to you through a real event, didn't it?
Yes, and I wanted to mention that. The first prose book that I wrote and published preceded the New York Trilogy. It was The Invention of Solitude, which is an autobiographical work. Well, this must be 1980, and I'd recently moved to Brooklyn. I was living in a very small apartment, and I was working on that other book, and the telephone rang, and I picked up. And the person on the other end said, "Is this the Pinkerton Agency?" Now, the Pinkerton, well, you laugh, so it means you must know what they are. But it's a very famous American detective agency. And I was distracted, and I said, "No, it's not the Pinkerton Agency. Wrong number." And I hung up, and I didn't think about it anymore that day. The next day, around the same time, same situation, sitting at my desk, the telephone rang. And I picked it up, and it was the same person from the day before. I recognized the voice. "Is this the Pinkerton Agency?" Again, I said, "No, wrong number," and I hung up. But that second time, when I hung up, I said to myself, "Why did I do that? Why didn't I say, yes, this is the Pinkerton Agency? Wouldn't it be interesting to know what this person wanted and what the case was? And what a fool I am for having blown this opportunity." So I kept waiting for the phone to ring again. But the third call never came. And I think that is what triggered off the idea to write the book as I did.
So your character, Quinn, does what you didn't do and
he gets the third call. He says no twice as well. And you see, that's why, in a sense, it had to be framed as a kind of pseudo-detective story. Because when you introduced the book early, you talked about a detective story. Well, these novels are not detective stories. They use elements of the genre, but for wholly other purposes. I think of myself using that mode, in the way that Cervantes used chivalric stories in Don Quixote, or Beckett used music hall routines for Waiting for Godot. You take a form, and then you take it somewhere else, and that's what I was doing. And I would think any devoted reader of mystery stories would be deeply disappointed by the New York Trilogy, and I would recommend not reading it, because detective stories are always giving solutions and answers, and these books simply ask questions, and then each question is answered with another question, and in the end, there's no definitive resolution about anything.
Well, as the title implies, this novel is either one novel or three novels, depending on how you look at it. And two of your readers have got very similar questions about that. One is Blanka Hmelikova in Prague in the Czech Republic, and she emailed this. "Dear Mr. Auster, allow me to ask you a question about your wonderful work, The New York Trilogy. Why, please, have you chosen the form of the trilogy?" And I also got a tweet from Matthew Smiley. He asked a slightly more detailed question. "Is trilogy intended to be three shorts expounding upon the same themes, or one cohesive whole to be reread and deduced?"
Well, I can give you the chronological development of how this all happened. I wrote City of Glass, and I have to say that much of the material that's in the book was taken from earlier writings of mine. When I was in my late teens and early 20s, I wrote hundreds and hundreds of pages of two or three novels that I wasn't capable of finishing. I was not old enough and experienced enough to complete these books. But they are the origins of City of Glass, Moon Palace, In the Country of Last Things. These are three books that were kicking around inside me very young. By the time I got to be about 23, with maybe 1,000 manuscript pages behind me, I said to myself, I'm not capable of writing fiction. I can't write novels. I give it up. And for years after that, I just concentrated on writing my poetry. Well, I got a bit older. Things changed in my life. I was writing The Invention of Solitude, my first finished prose work, book-length prose work, and it gave me the desire to return to attempt fiction. So many of the things from City of Glass were taken from these earlier manuscripts. So as I was writing the book, realizing what I was up to, I remembered something else I had written earlier. Back in the mid-70s, I wrote a number of one-act plays, and I'd never been very satisfied with them either. But one of the plays started to resonate within me as I was writing City of Glass, and that is Ghosts, which is the second panel of this trilogy, which had been, to my mind, a failed play, but I re-examined it and reinvented it as a work of prose fiction. So I still didn't have a trilogy in mind. But as I was starting Ghosts, the second volume, I realized there can't be just two. There has to be a third. This is a series of books that are all interconnected in some way, even though they're separate. And so the moment I started writing Ghosts, the idea for The Locked Room was already percolating inside me, and I realized it's going to be this trio. There are subtle references in The Locked Room, the final of the three, which refers to things that happen, particularly in Volume 1, in City of Glass.
And to characters. There are characters who reappear.
Exactly.
Well.
Quinn's name pops up again in The Locked Room, etc. There's certain thematic overlaps. For example, baseball appears in all three novels in one form or another.
I just assumed that was because you were American.
No, I happen to like baseball very much. But I wanted to make a kind of trio, a trilogy. I suppose a traditional trilogy has all the same characters. But no, it's a different kind of trilogy. Maybe we should call it New York Triptych, but that doesn't sound very good. So I opted for trilogy as the title.
Paul Auster, thank you very much. A question now from the World Book Club audience.
Virginia McGregor from Shinfield in Berkshire. New York is clearly one of the central characters in your trilogy. Were you to rewrite the novel today, and you might say that you wouldn't rewrite it today, but supposing you would, would this character have changed a great deal, or would it essentially be the same, do you think? Thank you.
Paul, before you answer that about whether and how New York may have changed over the years, just on the subject of New York, we had an email very last minute from Eriko Fuji in Japan, who said, by the way, that the news that you were going to be on the World Book Club hit me as a surprise, as I had just finished the New York trilogy. It was as if to prove the existence of serendipity, which so often features in your work. But that's by the by. He said, I was very much impressed with how precisely the essence of city life is captured in this book, although it's set in New York and I live in a middle-sized city in Japan. Which has rather moved away from your question, I'm afraid. The question was, how much has New York changed?
Well, New York has changed enormously in the 30-plus years since I wrote this. My experiences in New York in the 70s, which is what this book comes out of, really, it was a much rougher place than it is now. It was much more dangerous. It was much dirtier. It looked like New York was turning into a third-world city then. That's not the case now. The city is cleaner and safer. There's been a lot of construction. A lot of old buildings have been restored to magnificence, really. So I don't think that if I were to write these books now, they would feel the same. They represent a moment in New York City history. All that said, New York remains a crazy, lively, unpredictable, insane place. And I think of it as still the only city in the world that belongs to all of us. Everyone owns New York, whether you're from England or the United States or Japan, because it's a city in which over 40% of its residents were born in other countries. So we have the whole world there. We have every language, every religion, every color, every race, everything coexisting, every cuisine. And that's why there have been times when I imagined that it would be good for New York to break away from the United States, to declare its independence and become an independent city-state that belongs to the world.
That's quite inspiring.
Hello, Igor Memik. I wrote extensively on your work for my final year of university.
I feel sorry for you, but thank you for the effort.
I enjoyed every moment of it. I was hoping I might ask, a lot of your work, including the New York trilogy, occupies itself with the archetype of the eternal writer, drinking too much, never successful in relationships, always smoking. If I may ask, what is it about this man that you find such an alluring topic? And as well, what is it about notebooks specifically that draws these men in?
Because the New York trilogy has red notebooks, if I remember rightly, that recur through it like a theme, doesn't
yes.
it?
Okay, well, there are three questions. The first question is, you call the eternal writer. I don't know if any writer is eternal. It's true that in the novels I've written over the years, some of the protagonists have been writers. I think not as many as people might think, but it has happened. They all seem a bit different to me, but then again, maybe I'm deluded. Well, perhaps this goes back to the first question about autobiographical elements. I happen to be someone who spent his life in a room writing. And I do smoke, and I do drink probably more than I should. So maybe this is an autobiographical element that I'm barely even aware of. The thing about notebooks, however, is more compelling to me. I've always written by hand. I've never been able to compose on a keyboard, whether a typewriter or a computer. There's something about the tactility of a pen or a pencil in the hand pressing against the paper that seems for me to generate the words. Whereas with my fingers poised on the keys of a typewriter computer, I don't feel as free. I can't find the words as readily. So notebooks have become for me a kind of emblem of the inner life as expressed in language. And the notebook has become somehow a house for words for me. It's the dwelling in which, finally, I spend most of my time. What is the ultimate significance of this? You ask the meaning. I have no idea. But these are just things that I find very compelling, I'm drawn to, and I keep going back to them because I can't think about it in any other way.
If Paul doesn't know the meaning of the notebooks, ultimately, did you hazard a guess in your scholarly writings on him?
As a matter of fact, I did write on this subject. As a writer, as you mentioned, you start with a sentence or something that is ultimately so compelling. And such, I imagine, especially for someone who I know writes by hand, it's almost like an addictive quality of a notebook. When there's a work that's in progress, it must be something that is almost, addictive, almost drug-like.
Yeah, okay, I agree with you. I don't know if we've explained the meaning of it, but it's true that I have rather obsessive habits about it because there are notebooks and there are notebooks, and the ones that I like to use all have quadril lines, the little squares, like graph paper. That's what I write on. And whenever I travel, I look for good notebooks in different countries. So I wind up having notebooks from many different places, Norway, Germany, Portugal, France, Spain, and it gives me pleasure to use these while I'm doing my work. Yeah.
A question now that was sent into the BBC World Book Club from Victoria in Canada. It's from Kaelin Unruh. And he's written to ask this. It's a simple question, but probably not the simple answer. You've said that the New York trilogy isn't a detective novel, which, of course, in no conventional sense is it, although it does have mysteries. But Kaelin says, would you describe your relationship with detective novels?
Ah, okay. I can tell you that during the years when I was writing poetry and not writing fiction, for some reason I became very interested in the genre, and I read many scores, if not hundreds, of detective novels, often as a means of relaxation, because for many years I lived in straitened circumstances. I didn't have television, for example, and or even a radio, and many was the evening when I just spent reading. But I didn't want to read anything too difficult because I was exhausted, and I developed a taste for especially hard-boiled detective stories and detective novels. Now, it's very strange that once I went back to writing fiction myself, I stopped reading them. And I don't think I've read a detective novel in something like 35 years. But there was a time when I read them consistently. And I thought about the form a lot. And what's so interesting about the good ones is that, and I think this is why people keep reading them and why it's a form that will never really die out, it's because it's a plot-driven but galvanizing way of reading, because everything could be significant. And I think it makes you very alert as a reader. And that alertness brings pleasure. Because as we all know, the solutions in these detective stories are usually quite boring and uninteresting. And there's always this letdown when you get the answer. Because it has to be one thing and not all things. But when you have all things in your mind as a potential answer, that's when you feel most alive. So I think that's the strength of the genre and also the weakness of the genre. Because the fact is that you read these books and it's very difficult to remember them. And I know that I have sometimes read the same book twice, and I'm 150 pages in before I realize that, my goodness, I read this 5 years ago, and I'm reading it again, and I forgot every single word in the book.
It's very economical, mind you.
That's right. You buy one book, and you just keep reading it forever. Yeah.
An email now from Catherine Bardrick. She's a regular listener to the BBC World Book Club. And she only ever says, in terms of where she lives, that she lives on the French Riviera, which kind of tantalizes me. Yes. I imagine her eternally beside the Mediterranean in a one-piece white bathing costume with a sun hat on.
It's funny, I saw a bikini in my mind, but that's... right.
You're a man, I'm a woman. Anyway, Catherine, who is probably dressed like the rest of us, bundled up in coats and stuff, says this: to what extent is your trilogy a playful deconstruction of the conventional detective mystery, and to what extent is it a serious investigation into the nature of identity and reality? And she says in brackets, everyone who writes to you has got this kind of story. She says, incidentally, I left my copy of the novel by mistake in the rather elegant waiting room at Sacramento Railway Station, and often wondered who picked it up and whether they read it and enjoyed it as much as I did. I mean, this could come out of one of your novels. Anyway, to what extent are you playing games in this book, and to what extent seriously investigating the nature of identity?
I don't really think I'm playing games at all. As I said earlier, I'm referring to a genre, particularly, I would say, in the middle book, Ghosts, which has a private eye as the main character. I find that there's humor in the books, humor in all three of the books, and God knows we need humor, but these are not comedies by any means, and I feel that they are serious investigations of all these questions, essentially about what it means to be human, and this is what I've tried to explore in all my work for all these years, just simply, what does it mean to be human?
Paul Auster, thank you. It'd be good to hear another extract now from the New York trilogy. This is the opening of part two of the trilogy, Ghosts, which is very different from the other two in the sense that it's much more formal. It's almost like a game. The characters, as we'll find out, have the names of colours and so on.
Okay, well, I'll read the passage, then we'll talk about it. So this is the beginning of Ghosts. First of all, there is blue. Later, there is white. And then there is black. And before the beginning, there is brown. Brown broke him in. Brown taught him the ropes. And when brown grew old, blue took over. That is how it begins. The place is New York. The time is the present. And neither one will ever change. Blue goes to his office every day and sits at his desk, waiting for something to happen. For a long time, nothing does. And then a man named White walks through the door, and that is how it begins. The case seems simple enough. White wants Blue to follow a man named Black and to keep an eye on him for as long as necessary. While working for Brown, Blue did many tail jobs, and this one seems no different, perhaps even easier than most. Blue needs the work, and so he listens to White and doesn't ask many questions. He assumes it's a marriage case and that White is a jealous husband. White doesn't elaborate. He wants a weekly report, he says, sent to such and such a postbox number, typed out in duplicate on pages so long and so wide. A check will be sent each week to Blue in the mail. White then tells Blue where Black lives, what he looks like, and so on. When Blue asks White how long he thinks the case will last, White says he doesn't know. Just keep sending the reports, he says, until further notice.
Well, Paul Auster, as you say, this novel isn't a comedy, and that story in particular ends in a very, I think, disturbing way. But we've got this kind of distance from it. These are just names, really. We don't get a great deal about them as characters. So tell me about this idea of writing a book like that, or a story like that.
Well, the time is the present, meaning the book is written in the present tense, unlike the first and third. The book is also set in 1947, and the story begins on February 3rd, 1947, which happens to be the day I was born. There's a sense of the narrator being a kind of we. It has a fable-like quality, unlike the other two novels. I think of this book as the kind of the pivot of the three. So it has this fabular quality. And because of that, I think that's why I named all the characters after colors. Now, Brown is a real name. White is a real name. Black is a real name. There are people named Blue as well, and Green, etc. So it's not as though I'm calling them X, Y, and Z. So there is some resonance with reality. But once you group them all together, well, obviously as a reader, you see that something is happening. But you see, more specifically, how do you describe a color to a blind person? What does blue mean to someone who can't see blue? Or red to someone who can't see red? I suppose you can give the physics answer with a lot of numbers and formulas about waves of light and so on. But still, the person who had never seen red would not be able to imagine it. In the same way, it seems to me, people cannot be understood until they've been experienced, so to speak. I mean, you only get to know somebody by interacting with that person. So in a sense, the abstractness of, for example, you and I have just met today, and I don't know anything about you. I've never seen you, and I don't know where you're from or anything. So at this point, I'm like a blind man confronted with a color. If, for example, later on we went out and had a drink, we started talking, and you told me your life story, then I begin to have a sense of who you are. But it only comes out of experience. So those were some of the thoughts that went into the origin of this book. Later on, after the book was published, a friend of mine, someone I've known for years, said, "What this book is, Paul," he said, "is a kind of metaphorical story about what it means to read a book. That the book is about reading a book." And I think it's the most incisive thing I've ever heard about this. And I think there's something absolutely true. So you have the poor Blue, the detective, who really knows nothing, and he's hired to watch a man through a window and then follow him around. The man that he's watching is writing something, but he doesn't know what it is. And bit by bit, Blue gets sucked into this thing. And it is a bit what happens to a reader reading a book. And I think it's the best criticism I've ever heard.
Thank you very much. You're listening to the BBC World Book Club, where our guest this month is the American author Paul Auster, answering readers' questions about his best-selling novel, The New York Trilogy. And Paul, a question now very much from your part of the world. It's from Brooklyn, New York. It's from Ahmer Kadir, who writes, "Dear Paul, your stories are often infused with hidden orders or patterns, and I recently heard you describe in an interview being on vacation and discovering a piano in rural Maine which had the same key broken as your piano at home. Now, many readers would refer to these phenomena as coincidence, but you described it in that interview as cosmic rhyming, yet you don't seem to be religious or have much of a spiritual bent. So where do you think this ordering or patterning comes from?"
Good question. He's referring to something from The Invention of Solitude, a book before the New York Trilogy. And it was true. This is something that happened back in the 1960s. I had a girlfriend at the time who played the piano very well, and the F above middle C on her piano was broken. That summer, the two of us went to rural Maine, and we walked into an abandoned lodge, some kind of men's organization, with Indian headdresses and all kinds of weird paraphernalia, all dusty. It had been abandoned for years, and there was a piano there, and it all worked except the F above middle C. All right. Yeah, it's a coincidence. It doesn't mean anything, and I'm not looking for any kind of spiritual or mystical illumination out of this coincidence. But it nevertheless is haunting, isn't it? I mean, why that particular note? So what I've evolved over the years is this phrase that eliminates God and spirituality from these events. I just call it the mechanics of reality, because with surprising repetition, things like this happen. And I know it doesn't mean anything, but it's just, if you're looking closely at the way things work in the world, you'll be amazed at how they defy expectations, how often the unimaginable, the impossible, is happening to us.
Another question. Yes, there's a guy with two hands up over there.
Sir, my name is Paul Auster. It is, genuinely, and I'm a musician. I wrote to you in the 1990s, and I live locally in Gloucestershire. I smoke and drink too much like yourself. The first book I read was The Music of Chance, and I kept it on my shelf in my classroom for the kids to give me some respect. And when I was reading The Invention of Solitude, the coincidence was just unbelievable, because it was the time my own father died and my first son, who's sitting with me, Henry, was born, and your book was about going from being the son of a father to the father of a son. The coincidences go on and on.
I keep going. I'm really fascinated.
Probably what I shouldn't say, because it's going well, is that I am not an avid reader of books. But because of your name and the coincidences, I keep reading yours, and they're great fun. Can you promise that you'll keep writing as long as health permits? And may I suggest an inspiration for a future project to combine your love of literature and poetry and mind of music, and maybe write something, a show, musical, or best of all, opera?
Well, thank you. I'm overwhelmed. I know that there are other Paul Austers in the world, but I've never actually met one. And to find him in England, how interesting and wonderful. Just before we stop talking about, what kind of musician are you? What do you do with music? I'm curious.
I've tried writing music, like you write, words, but I struggle to actually put them down on paper. I've been fascinated what you've said earlier, how you start to write a book. Probably that's why I'm a jazz musician, because I don't have to write anything down
right.
at all.
And you teach as well, I gather, huh?
I taught.
You taught. That's wonderful.
I still perform.
Well, I have one little thing to say. which might please you, is that my daughter, who is now just turned 25, is a musician and a singer. And she's devoting her life to music, and it's quite wonderful to have this in our family now. Because of all things, of all arts, I think it's music that I care about the most. I listen to music often, and I've always cared about it. And my taste in music is very broad. I'm particularly interested in classical music. Opera, I like very much. But also jazz, even rock and roll, all kinds of music mean tremendous things to me. It's the one art that allows us to melt into the universe. Huh? It's the one maybe that is below and above and around all the others, and the one that is impossible to talk about. But you, when you experience it, you know what's happening in you, and it's an extraordinary thing. So anyway, I'm really touched that you showed up today, and thank you for being here.
Well, now we've got a slightly more conventional question, I'm afraid, from which was rung into the BBC World Book Club from Sofia in Bulgaria. It's from Ina Vasileva, and here she is to ask it now.
Hello, Paul. My name is Ina Vasileva from Sofia, Bulgaria. I've got a question for you. In the New York trilogy, you write about the connection between a writer and a character. Can writing fiction be a two-way process? Have any of your characters changed you as a person in the process of writing? Greetings from Bulgaria.
Wow, Bulgaria. How do you like that?
I like it a lot.
Yeah.
So has the creation of a character actually changed you as you have been creating the character ever?
Not really, no. I mean, I know that I'm a bit odd, but I'm not completely crazy. I remember that old Ronald Coleman movie of the actor who takes over the part and he thinks he is the character. No, I've never gone that far. But I will say that the characters in my novels, the ones that I've lived with often for many years, feel real to me. And they feel as real to me as the people I know, the people sitting in this room. They're just as real, so real that in one of my later novels, Travels in the Scriptorium, I do explore this relationship between writer and characters that he creates. Because the strange thing is that these imaginary beings created out of the minds of authors outlive the authors. The imaginary trumps the real. And this is so interesting to me. So that I'll die in X number of years, and if my books are any good, God knows, who knows what happens, you know, after. But if they do live on for a little bit, those characters are going to be living, and I'm not. And I find this a fascinating idea.
Paul Auster, would you read for us now from the beginning of the third part of the New York trilogy? This is the start of the section that's called The Locked Room.
The Locked Room, yes. It seems to me now that Fanshawe was always there. He is the place where everything begins for me, and without him, I would hardly know who I am. We met before we could talk, babies crawling through the grass in diapers. And by the time we were seven, we had pricked our fingers with pins and made ourselves blood brothers for life. Whenever I think of my childhood now, I see Fanshawe. But that was a long time ago. We grew up, went off to different places, drifted apart. None of that is very strange, I think. Our lives carry us along in ways we cannot control, and almost nothing stays with us. It dies when we do. And death is something that happens to us every day. 7 years ago, this November, I received a letter from a woman named Sophie Fanshawe. You don't know me, the letter began, and I apologize for writing to you like this out of the blue, but things have happened, and under the circumstances, I don't have much choice. It turned out that she was Fanshawe's wife. The explanation came in the second paragraph, very bluntly, without any preamble. Fanshawe had disappeared, she wrote, and it was more than 6 months since she'd last seen him. Not a word in all that time, not the slightest clue as to where he might be. Nothing was sure, but the facts seemed to speak for themselves. Fanshawe was probably dead. It was pointless to think he would be coming back. In the light of all this, there was something important she needed to discuss with me, and she wondered if I would agree to see her.
Paul Auster, thank you. Well, we have a question which relates to that part of the trilogy. It's from Josef Sverka, who is a Swede living in New Delhi in India. And he writes that in the New York trilogy, I sense a theme of alienation, or actually of the observer of society being alienated and even pushed out of society. Take the protagonist in the locked room, for example. The more he inquires into the story of Fanshawe, the more alienated he becomes from Sophie. Is it the case that the more one looks at the human condition, the more alienated one will be from humanity?
No, I don't think so at all. He might be right in the case of this book, but as a general statement, no. I think the more we study humanity, the more closely bound to it we feel.
And yet all three central characters in the three parts of this novel are studying somebody they've either been paid to watch, or somebody they are following because they want to protect somebody else, or somebody, an old friend they're trying to find out, trying to track them down, and so on. And as a result of that, they do begin to loosen their ties with the rest of the world, more or less disastrously.
Yes, more or less disastrously, except in the case of the third protagonist, who never is given a name. We don't know what his name is, but the man who marries Sophie after Fanshawe disappears, he almost loses his mind, and he almost loses Sophie, and he goes through a kind of hell. But in the end, he pulls himself back, and the book, it doesn't end tragically. I mean, he's not destroyed by this, but nearly. And I think it's the question of someone finally being able to break a bond that is a sick bond, that is hurting him, not helping him. And in the end, he finally manages to do this. And it's especially vivid when he tears up the manuscript that Fanshawe gives him in the last pages of the book. And he says, all right, the spell is over. I'm going back home, and it's done. And it's bleak. And Fanshawe is the one who is the most tormented, the most ill, finally. But the protagonist finally is able to say goodbye to it. But it's a wrenching book, I feel. Yeah.
And it's a red notebook he tears up.
That's right.
Hello, I'm Helen Powell from Cheltenham. I'm very interested in the way you use language, and I'm interested that no one's asked you about that yet. So I'd like to know, does the language just come to you naturally, like the first sentence of your books, or the last sentence sometimes, or is it a little bit more self-conscious than that?
When you say the use of language, what in particular are you talking about?
I mean that when Paul reads from his books, it doesn't sound like Paul talking to us and answering questions now. So I think you used to be a translator and a poet, and I've always imagined that the use of language is as important to you, perhaps, as the forming of characters and plot. So could you just tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I'm glad you asked this, because, of course, this is what it's all about. I mean, there is nothing else. And for me, even though these passages that I've read are in very simple, easily comprehensible language, enormous amounts of effort went into creating that simplicity. I'm an obsessive rewriter. I am writing paragraphs over and over and over again, 5 times, 10 times, 20 times, in order to find the music in the language that somehow corresponds to the meanings I'm hoping to convey. And it's all such an intuitive process that I can never give any kind of rational justification about it, but intuitively I say, that's what it should sound like. And every book that I write has its own special music, and I'm always searching for it and trying to capture it on the page. That's where all the effort comes. It's music. And music creates, we were talking about music before, music, even though you can't articulate it, is where all the meanings are. And this is the big difference between newspaper articles and novels, you see, between a magazine piece and a poem. You know, it's language. In all instances, it's language. I think people who don't like fiction too much and have trouble reading it are not sensitive to the music of language. And they're always looking for, you know, language as a conveyor of information, period. But you see, language is sound. Sound coming from the mouth, but sound in the head as you're reading as well. And that's where the beauty and the power of all literary art is. It's in the language. So yes, it's fundamental. It's a thing. It's the reason why it takes so long to write books. You know, you can write a newspaper article pretty fast, but writing a page of fiction can take a long, long time.
Hello, Paul. My name's Karen Squire. I'm from Plymouth here in England. I just wanted to know, who are your comfort authors, the people you might go back to time and time again to reread for whatever reason?
Thank you. That's a good question. I can tell you who I keep going back to. Some of them are very obvious answers because I think these are the people that thousands, if not millions of people kept going back to. Number one would be Shakespeare. I keep reading Shakespeare because it's inexhaustible. But also from that same period, Montaigne, the French essay writer, I think is someone I started reading when I was about 19 years old, and I keep going back to it. I keep learning from him. He's an eternal source of inspiration. The novel that I go back to more than any other is Don Quixote. Again, it's all from the same period. You know, we're talking 16th, early 17th century. Because Cervantes, in that enormous two-pronged novel, raised every question that fiction writers can possibly ask and have asked in the hundreds of years since then. Dickens, also. I think Dickens for the language more than anything else. And then my beloved Americans, Hawthorne and Melville and Thoreau. Those are the ones I go... And Emily Dickinson, whose poems I read and reread and reread. And she's a great mystery. It's so difficult to understand what she's talking about. And this goes back to the music of the language. She's singing about the human soul. And however difficult it might be to penetrate what she's saying, something is always getting through. So she's one of my very favorite writers. And in the more contemporary, I would say, of the 20th century, Kafka is the one that I keep going back to more than any other writer. He too is inexhaustible. He too defies all critics. You can't really put your finger on it, what he's doing. And I guess this is a good place to end, because I think the better the literature, the more there is to say about it, because the less you can say just one thing about it. You can come at a good work of art from 72 points of view. Each one will be valid, but none of them, it tells the whole story. So it's the inexhaustible that I'm interested in.
And we really do have to end there, but we will be back next month when one of New Zealand's leading novelists, C.K. Stead, will be talking about My Name Was Judas, his provocative and witty reimagining of the Jesus story. That'll be the first weekend in December, so do make a date to join us. In the meantime, you can find out what we're up to on Facebook, and if you'd like to come along to one of our recordings, our email address is worldbookclub@bbc.co.uk. Also, do check our archive of more than 100 World Book Club interviews. Go to bbcworldservice.com/worldbookclub. For now, though, from me, Harriet Gilbert, and producer Karen Holden, thank you to all you members of the BBC World Book Club, whether listening at home or here at the Cheltenham Literature Festival. And, of course, special thanks to this month's guest, Paul Auster.
People Fixing the World is the podcast looking for solutions to the problems we face today.
It could potentially ease the suffering of millions.
We meet people with smart ideas to discover how they might change the world for the better.
And this is a fairly cheap and easy way to get lots more solar capacity into the middle of cities.
People Fixing the World from the BBC World Service.
We have a solution. Let's do it.
Listen now, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.